Coffee for today's episode of the Morning Spotlight podcast was provided by Spotlighter B. Evans. Thanks, B. Really appreciate it. And for all you Spotlighters out there, if you want to support the show and keep us caffeinated, go to themorningspotlight.com and click Buy Mike a Coffee. The Morning Spotlight podcast is sponsored by Fidelity National Title Group, the nation's largest group of title companies and title insurance underwriters that collectively issue more title insurance policies than any other title company in the United States. If you have questions, need a quote, or want to place an order, shoot yours truly, the coolest guy in title insurance, an email, and I'll be happy to help. Check the show notes for my email address. Good morning and welcome to the Morning Spotlight podcast. I'm your host, Mike Hamm, coming to you as always from the Spotlight Studios here in Morristown, New Jersey. My guest today began in sales and marketing at 16 years old, selling toys door to door, and eventually stumbled into the world of selling cars at staffed event sales all over the country. Eventually in 2008, he explored a passion for making videos and successfully started a nationally recognized custom video studio with his brother in the heart of Seattle that was focused on the automotive industry. He's also a military paratrooper veteran who took a 2017 viral video and used it to partner with Paws and Stripes to help combat the unfortunate number of veterans who take their own lives each year. He is Andrew Myers. Andrew, welcome to the show.
Mike, thank you. Thank you.
Of course. Of course. It's great to have you here. You are a connection through my buddies over at Podmax, which is awesome because I always love getting guests from Podmax because they always rock. So no pressure, but you gotta rock.
Yeah, now I have to. There's no choice, no way around it. I consumed a couple of your podcasts on a plane ride the other day. I love the nature of your show. You go wherever the road may take you.
Yeah, we do not plan. We are just like all over the place, and we usually try to get some good stuff, and usually it works. But I'm looking at all the stuff because I have stuff on you, like some of my own research, some of the stuff that Josh had sent over, and I have no idea where this episode is going to go. Usually I have an idea in my head of what I want to talk about, but there's so much here that I want to get to. So let's start from the beginning. So one of the first things that Josh told me about you was that you're a high school dropout because you were too smart. Can you explain what that means?
Well, that might've been Josh's take on it. I think my teachers might've disagreed. No, what I did in like seventh grade, take this. I was from Indiana, and Indiana doesn't have the best, you know, educational system. No, you know, they tried. But at some point in like the seventh or eighth grade, like summer, they have an Indiana placement test. And if you have to pass this as a senior. And so they feed me this test as an eighth grader, and I passed. Like I was in the upper percentile of graduating seniors. And, you know, if I had more focused parents, they probably would have been like, do you really want to do this high school thing? You know, you kind of already are through it. Yeah. And instead, they'd let me go for 3.5 years and never get a credit because I wouldn't do the homework. And it's just an interesting story. I was just a regular old, didn't do the work. You know, I get A's on the test, didn't do the homework. And that stopped averaging out as a C at some point. And they started going, well, if you don't do the work, you're not getting any credit. Yeah. Right. So then they started just giving me like hall pass. I go to school, I'd have like a study hall and 3 hall pass things. But no, I just, school's tough, man. We talked about this on Larry's show the other day. It's weird that they teach it at sort of their own pace. You know, you have to move with the herd. And that's something that's been a metaphor in business also as I've gotten older is, if that's not your pace, sometimes it's hard to walk that slow. I remember my first day selling cars. That was actually my first question. I said, man, these customers, man, they walk slow. How do you stay with them? And the guy goes, well, you just gotta hang the leg, kind of kick it out there and don't pull it back in for a while. Because being a military guy, I'd be like, let's go look at this car. And then I look behind me and they're 15 yards behind me. I'm like, well, I guess I need to go your pace. So I was just a little too ADD for school. And you know, the first 2 minutes I'd be like, got it. Interesting premise. And then they'd put another 45 minutes into it and kids are raising their hand, asking questions. It just wasn't my speed, but I did do, they had a career center that allowed you to kind of like make these projects for a metal class. And I burned through their, year and a half curriculum and had a job within like a few months. So school just started to seem ridiculous. And I started asking people, hey, man, when was the last time you ever showed somebody your high school diploma? I started asking like cousins and uncles that at parties, you know, and they're like, what are you doing? I work at the trash place. Did they ask to see your diploma? And they're always like, no. I'm like, so what are we doing here exactly?
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. I mean, like I have, you know, a bachelor's degree. I graduated from high school. I have a bachelor's degree and a master's degree. Nobody's ever asked me to see any of those things in my entire life. I'm only 31, but I doubt the older I get, the more relevant those things are going to wind up being. But, you know, I got the master's for free. So that was like a cool.
Well, and I was watching like Catch Me If You Can. And I was thinking, man, at the very worst, if you handed somebody a document, in what way would they ever verify it? You know what I mean? They'd be like, oh, it looks good. That was my plan.
Right. Yeah. This is from now, a now defunct high school. It doesn't exist anymore. There's nobody you can call one of those.
No one's going to know.
Yeah. Right.
And that's what ended up happening is I joined the military and they were like, hey, you could, I got a really good placement score on their, like, you know, their exam. And they said, but you got to have a diploma to get these jobs that you want. So I went to a school. I actually have a real high school diploma. So I dropped out of my school, never went to a graduation, but I have not a GED, a real diploma. And they just fed me a couple of workbooks. And then I filled out or fed me some tests. And then I ended up having to do like two additional workbooks. And they were like, here's your diploma. I'm like, where was this 4 years ago? You know, I could have been Doogie Howser, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
dating some immature, you know, college sophomore at 16. I'd have been the man. But yeah, I'm very cautious now about how my daughter fits into the education system. Because, you know, she went to school today wearing a cape and a dress. Okay. And, you know, she picked it out. So I'm like, well, do you, but we're not going to let them slow you down.
Exactly. No, I love that. So you mentioned 16 years old. So in that bio that I had read about you at the very beginning, it said that you were selling toys door to door at 16 years old. So was that just part of like you just were doing a lot of different things? Was that the through the career center thing?
No, I got kicked out of that career center because one of the careers they were training you on was how to be a police officer. So they were taking these kids out and sweeping vehicles in the parking lot. And I had beer in my truck or something like that. I remember getting called into the principal's office and they slapped the beer on the counter. And my first comment I made was, hey, that's my beer. And I remember thinking, I bet that's not what they thought I was going to say.
Yeah, right.
But, you know, you needed to get a job. I came from Indiana where I can remember the first examples of entrepreneurialism. The first examples, I mean, when you're a kid, you're like, I can remember my brother asking, like, well, how do they decide which businesses go where? Like, you don't know how things work. And I remember thinking, how did this person become the owner of a laundromat? And how did I had a friend who his parents had won the lottery, but it was only like $25,000. But they paid off their cars and started a business called Night Moods, which is actually like a lingerie place. And this $25,000 just totally changed their life. Now they were business owners and they had good money. And it was just like, it was just such a, it was such a weird environment in Indiana where I didn't know people who thought outside the box. And when I would tell my family, I wanted this, or I have these goals, you know, they would look at me like, well, what's wrong with our life? Why is what we had not good enough for you? And when people talk about having to grow your circle or migrate from your circle in order to grow yourself, I think that's a lot of what they're expressing is some of these people in small towns, you know, the minute that having a pontoon boat and a house on the river is not your dream, it's like, well, that was my dream. Why do you feel more entitled than I do? You know?
Right.
So, I was always really, really curious about business. I had a popsicle hustle in high school selling candy out of my bag, started with the green caramel apple suckers. You remember those?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
It's a great place to start a business. Undeniable product.
100%.
But you know, I was always good at people as an empath. I always could put myself in their shoes. So I always did well at sales. But I was an introvert. I was the exact opposite of who I am now. I mean, I was a coder. I'd sit in class. I never had kissed a girl in high school. I was friends with everybody, but I just didn't, you know, I didn't do that. And so I actually thought when I went to get that job that I was working at a warehouse. They write these really clever ads and they make it sound like you're going to be the warehouse manager. I thought, man, I got no experience. If they're going to hire me as a manager, let's go. And next thing you know, they're loading a bag full of toys and, you know, it's weird stuff. Disney, you know, coloring books and Samsonite luggage and just stuff that fits in the bag. And she just started going door to door. And like everyone tells you no. I mean, you talk to 300 people a day and 280 people tell you to booger off in one way or another.
Yeah.
And but you learn so much. I mean, I got to figure out now how to get my daughter in a spot where she can have that experience. Because the people who go through that, they learn how sales works. They learn how to be short and concise and have messages that influence people more often than not. They're very good at testing things because they got a lot of exposure. You get to the other side of the sales coin and they try to get everything perfect so that the next person will say yes. But that, you know, the art of sales is not getting the person that's in front of you to say yes. It's filling your pipeline.
Yeah.
And going door to door teaches you, man, if I talk to 300 people today, I will find the business, you know, that I need. So it was an unbelievable experience. And not only that, but you know, what you do to build rapport is often stand in a hobby shop and talk to the business owner. Well, how'd you get here? How did you? So my education on what it meant to start a business, the motivation, the workload, it was really that. It was like I was making friends with these local business owners. We would just go like to a downtown Main Street. And, you know, everybody had a story, and it allowed me to sort of map what it meant to own a business and how you got to that spot and realize the government wasn't handing out businesses.
Right.
these people were making these things.
Yeah, no, exactly. So I love a lot of what you just said. So as someone that works in sales, so I sell title insurance for a living, and I was a college baseball coach prior to this. So while that was sales from like recruiting standpoint, it's not necessarily like sales, I guess. I mean, there's things that I took out of it. But I think like one of the biggest hurdles that I had to clear at the very beginning, I'm 4 years in at this point in my career selling this stuff, but the no factor was obviously like a big thing. So, you know, being a door-to-door toy salesman at 16 years old, obviously, like you said, it's not trying to get the next person to say yes, it's filling up the pipeline. But how do you, like, was it dejecting at the very beginning when you started getting those no's, or was it something where you just kind of kept?
Well, no, I sort of latched on to the real way to do it. And to this day, I've got people who sit in on demos I do with clients, and they go, "You never asked. You just kept talking." And then they were like, "All right, let's do this. You know, send me the agreement." I learned very quickly, because some people, they get completely beaten up by it. And and some people, they're not out to say no, thank you. I mean, they're out to say, you know, "You're a bum, get a real job, get the hell out of my store," you know, and everything else. And you just process them as all a different type of no. But what I learned very quickly was the trial close. I learned how to tell where I was with somebody. And I often didn't ask them, "Do you want to buy this?" That never really came up. You know, I could tell by, I'd show them multiple products. I'd find the one they're interested in. The thing I did that made me, you know, like nationally ranked at this, when they thought I was 21 and I was like 16, was instead of saying "This product is $35 today, I have it for $10, boom, I would show them multiple things. And then I could tell which one they were most interested in. And I would say, "This product's $35. You can get it today for only 30, but I'm going to give you this, and this for free." And so, you get, you know, and then what I'd say is like close is like, "So will that be enough, or do you want two sets like that?" You know, and then if they didn't, like, "No, actually, I don't want anything." Okay, so that's why playing the numbers game is so advantageous, is you learn to take a no. So, you know, same thing like getting in a fight. I mean, if you've ever been in a fight and then you catch that right cross on the chin and you think, "Oh baby, I'm still in this," you know, I got a
not
shot
normally,
you know,
but yes.
You know, but you know, everybody eats that first punch, and you know, you're not sure you're gonna see the kapow from the Batman series and wake up on the couch, or you know, how are you doing?
Yeah.
And you do that, you eat that first punch, and you realize, "Man, I could probably do four more of those, be all right."
Yeah. Right.
And that, you know, and you build up a resilience. You do two things. You build up a resilience to hearing no. You learn how to carry yourself when you've been rejected, but you also learn how to sort of trial close people in a way where you can find out that the answer is no without asking. And between those two things, those skills really take you everywhere when it comes time to go do what you want to do. Because most people, I counsel a lot of people on how to develop their business. And one of the things I always do is I get them to the doorway of their opportunity. And then I say, "Okay, go get 25 people to say no, thanks."
Yeah.
And they're like, "What?" Yeah. "I don't want you to try to cherry pick, bro, the people who you think will buy. I want you to dare the universe that you can't collect your 25 no's and not find your four yeses. And if you go find those four clients, you'll be started. So don't think, who are the four people? Think, how can I aggregate a group of 30 prospects and go hit them all and get my no's, collect my no thanks, bros."
Yeah.
Because what you're going to do is you're going to refine your pitch. You're going to refine your process. And eventually you're just going to bump into a guy who goes, "Oh, I was just talking to my wife about this last night." You know, there'll be more luck than anything.
Yeah.
You know, we used to carry little purple bear clocks. And I mean, you'd run into people who go, "Man, I've been late. I've been needing to get a clock." You'd run into people who go, "Oh, I love bears." You look around and all this crap in their office is bears. You'll run into people who love purple, and you'll find me as being a great salesman had very little to do with moving this product. It was about getting it in a desirable light in front of the right person at the right time.
Yeah, no, exactly. It's like you got to cast the net to catch some fish. That's really what it comes down to. I love that. What I also think is interesting, and like I said, there was a lot that we need to get to in this episode, so I'm going to try to weave some of this stuff together. But we talk about how you're outside the box. You know, you were an introvert, but you were doing different things and thinking outside the box and thinking differently than maybe what your parents or your community or all that, what they maybe had in mind for their lives or your life or whatever.
I think when you're a kid looking at adults, results, you either look at them and think, man, that's what I should do. Or you look at them and think, that's not what I should do. And everyone in my community was an example of something I didn't want to do.
Right.
Yeah, out.
But you know what I think is maybe the most interesting part of this is that at some point in this trajectory of life, you go from being this door-to-door kid, a kid going door-to-door selling toys and magazines and stuff, to eventually you go into the military, which I feel like is probably the most structured type of organization in the world. So how do you make that jump and think like, hey, this is next? Or is that just like a random thing that you want?
No, it was the exact observation is I started my life young at 16. So by the time I was 21, I had really been around and done a lot. I had spoken to groups of people who thought I was in my 20s and, you know, I'd had my own business. I also had a business making coupons. We would work out like organized marketing deals with like paintball places, hair salons, golf courses, and design this on a perforated card sheet type of thing and then go sell them at colleges and stuff. And, you know, I had never lived within the rules. Like I said, I was the kind of kid who was thinking, could I forge a college diploma and get away with it? I mean, that was where my head was, you know, right. I just did whatever. I was big into like, if there's no consequences for a thing and it's not morally wrong, then that's where I want to be. Or even if it is sort of morally wrong. So my thought process was, what's the exact opposite of this? How do I put myself on the exact other end of the spectrum and then find a balance somewhere there in the middle? So I had sort of gotten to the point at 21 where I'd had a lot of good experiences. I'd been to a lot of parties. I'd hung out with people. We were trading those coupons for free hotels. So I could just give people, we were doing the rave scene and I had all the hotels. So I became sort of a member of that community that was important because I could, you know, get half a floor of hotels by trading. And I went hard, but I didn't feel like I was going towards anything other than experiences, you know? And I thought, all right, I got to get a base underneath me here. And that base for me was the VA home loan, man. That's what I was still in a mindset where I thought, man, you know what rich people do? They own their own home. And that to me was like the first pillar that I thought, man, if I can, you know, at least by the time I'm 25, 26, come out, VA home loan, I won't be stuck in an apartment forever. And that's where my head was. And that, and just, again, just the experience. I read something from Oliver Stone about how almost every character he'd ever written, I was kind of planning on being a writer, had come from somebody he had met while deployed or in basic training. And he had, or an aggregation of two people, you know, this is a mixture of Mike and Paul. And I thought, well, hell, I don't know anybody like that. Everyone I've met has been very, you know, I bumped into them through organic means and we've adventured as much as we can, but I want to meet somebody totally different than me. I want to meet people from every state and everything else. So I actually ended up in the 82nd Airborne, the All Americans, named for the fact that the original assembly of paratroopers were, there was one from every state. They drew from every state.
Interesting.
So I like that idea. And I just knew, you know, I knew that it'd be uncomfortable, but I knew that, you know, a better me would result 4 years later.
Right. So explain to me going into the military and then going like, I'm just going to jump out of planes. Like, was that like where you got placed? How does that work? Cause I am unfamiliar with that process.
That is a funny one. I've wondered that myself often.
I originally signed up for it. Honestly, it seems to fit. So if you're going to do anything in the military, which I think like you're trying to get that base under you, why don't you just do the one where like, we're just going to jump out of a plane and then into wherever we're going to jump into.
Yeah. I feel
like
that would be, well, what I thought too was like, that's at least a voluntary, cause this was in 2004. There was a lot of people, you know, murmuring incorrectly that there'd be a draft or, you know, we were all very worried. Yeah. And my thought also was that like a lot of the people I'd met at MEPS and in the recruiting process, they were running from something. They had just knocked somebody up or beat somebody up or, you know, ran somebody over or, you know, and they were all going somewhere to get away from where they were. And I wasn't that guy. So I thought, let me at least make sure that the people in the foxhole with me wanted to be that upper echelon of people. You know, they wanted to go the extra mile. They wanted, maybe not wanted to be there because that turned out definitely not to be true. But at least, you know, I've always been a bit of an elitist. And I thought, let me just hang out with the people that knew. That was part of it. The other part of it is I had a brother who was military, 2 years older than me and had went to join the army. He had tried to be a paratrooper and failed, didn't pass the school. So, I mean, come on, that was my chance to leapfrog, you know,
exactly.
It was a little bit of that, but, they eventually, I signed up for it and they didn't put it on my orders. And I was like, yeah, don't really care. You know, didn't really want to do it anyways. But I had some idea in my head when I joined that I never wanted to go to Iraq. I just never wanted anything to do with Iraq. I knew how hot it would be. And I actually, the job I took to take advantage of the, my GT score, instead of being like a linguist, turned out to be 13 Delta. So I was the guy that would actually do the math to calculate how to put an artillery round, you know, in a doorway, you know, 8 miles away. Right. So this round stays in the air for 50 seconds, a minute at a time. It's spinning, it's rifled like anything else. So it drifts to the right the entire time it's in the air. The earth actually spins underneath the round while it's in the air. And the weather plays a massive effect on the round. So there's a lot of physics and math that go into it.
Yeah.
And I always knew if I was going to go to Iraq, I'd be just kicking indoors with a bunch of guys that had never been trained to do that. And, you know, somebody started shooting at us, we would react just like a fraternity of people playing paintball. You know what I mean? Right. Oh, crap. You know, like it'd just be, you know, it's not what we were trained to do. And I didn't want to be in that position. So they sent me to Fort Stewart. I land there and he goes, "Hey, we just shipped to Iraq." And I'm like, "Bummer. See you in a year." You know, and he goes, "No, you're coming tomorrow. As soon as you're done with repo, we're going to have you come late." I thought, so I'm the last one there, last one to get a job, lowest ranking with a group of people who don't know what they're doing. So I actually was like, "No, I'm not." And I like went AWOL to the JAG office and dug through my records and was like, "I'm a paratrooper, bro. My grandpa was, and you know, this is why I joined the Army." So I found out that the 82nd was going to Afghanistan. And so that was, I think that's the biggest factor, honestly, was that I just wanted to go to Afghanistan and not Iraq.
Right.
And so next thing you know, you're in jump school and, you know, things happen fast. But the irony of it is, you know, my job, again, we didn't ever jump into combat, thankfully, but my job was to fly right to where the enemy was, jump out of a perfectly good airplane, float to the ground, and then peel back like 5 or 6 miles and do some math, which I always thought was a very funny way to go to war. You know what I mean? With a calculator in your pocket and, you know, sitting there with a radio with officers near you. So, yeah, it was I just got unbelievably fortunate when we did deploy to Afghanistan. We got there last. We were part of a best gun competition, so we had stayed back. And we got there and bumped into this special forces crew that were late and took us on a mission. And we stayed up all night and really kind of overworked and were more valuable to them than they expected. And they said, "Man, we'd love you guys to come with us." And the alternative was we'd have been stuck in like Kandahar pulling tower guard all year. And so they were like, "Yeah, we'd love to." And they're like, "Well, we won't be back for 6 months. So we'll station you out at this little post and nobody will bother you for 6 months. And we'll pick you back up when we come back out." And we're like, "Awesome."
Yeah.
So yeah, the first 6 months was like lifting weights, tanning. We all looked yoked. And this is literally right when Halo had come out. And yeah. So we were on a local network with 19 dudes, not much to do, a little bit of artillery training, 7 or 8 hours of Halo a day. The internet was pretty strong. It was fantastic. And then they came back and gobbled us. And if you ever watched the show Green Berets from National Geographic, it's from probably 2006, the plane that those documentary people got off on, we got on. That was our ride out of there. Oh, cool. I remember seeing them coming off without weapons and cases and stuff. And I'm like, "What are they doing here?" And then lo and behold, when that show came out, I realized that's literally where I left and put two and two together. But yeah, so then the last 6 months was like a real war. These SF guys are amazing. They're the coolest group of guys. They taught me so much about building that circle around you. Then none of them have an ego. They're all just alpha males that don't have that hang up of being alpha. They really take their job seriously. And those guys went looking for a fight every other day. And, you know, we got to be there to support them, feel like we were actually doing something rather than just staring out at the desert. So, Right. Yeah, my overall military experience, unbelievably fortunate. We got back. We're like, "How great was that?" And everybody that was at Kandahar was like, "I got to eat knockoff Pizza Hut, but I had to shave every day. I had a beard." You know what I mean? I thought I was SF.
Yeah. Right.
But to this day, my uniform, I actually can wear the Special Forces combat patch without the Special Forces tab. Which I've had a few people back in the day freak out thinking that you were, you know, stealing valor or whatever. But I had to carry the orders on me. I'm like, "No, Playboy."
Right. Yeah.
So yeah, we went really well. You know, I enjoyed it, but I can see how it's definitely not for everybody. But that structure is good. If you've never had that, I think it's good that you at least taste it and see it. You know, maybe not live in that environment, but you don't want to pass 25 without any respect for people, without still having that sense of importance about yourself. You know, it rinses you of a lot of those immaturities, if you will.
Right. Yeah, no, 100%. And also, I was told to ask you about the first time that you jumped out of a plane. What happened and what did you learn from that?
Well, I just learned that being a paratrooper sucks. So bad. It really does suck. I had like 35 jumps and I because I started to learn that you could get on a jump and like your division has to feed a certain amount of shoots. So if you volunteered for it, they'd kind of leave you alone for the rest of the week. You get a day off before you do that day and then another day off, and then everything was interrupted. So I volunteered for a ton, and I was pretty sure that I was going to not jump that time every single time. And then once they get you up there, you're so claustrophobic, you're flying around in this crappy old plane. And by the time that green light comes on and you smell the fresh air, you're like, just let me out. You know, forget what I was saying a minute ago. I am going out.
Yeah.
But yeah, my first jump, there was a hurricane. I don't remember which one it was. And so they cut our jump week short. So instead of doing a jump a day, we did 3 jumps one day and 2 jumps the next day. And it was literally like they'd land, throw you back up there, and you'd jump out again. And we missed tower week. So I had never even been under a chute like that. And so that went all right. And then we get to the division and they're like, so we're having the Army Navy game today. And there's going to be a camera at the back of the thing. And I thought, oh boy, I just got here. My family's going to see me jumping with the 82nd on primetime TV, you know? Yeah. So when you jump, you really got to forcefully exit the door, or the leading part of your body will get hit by the wind and cause you to spin. And so I was more interested in looking cool for the camera. So I was trying to like crip walk down the thing with the bag on my legs and everything else. And I just got a really weak exit into the wind. And I did notice it felt a little weird. I thought maybe their parachutes were different. And the risers were like pressed as a V against my neck. And so I never really felt the whoomph happen. So I just kept pulling real hard and kicking. And finally it kind of straightens me out. And there's a bag on you that you pull a handle, and the bag's actually tied to you with a long rope, and it drops the bag. That way, when you crash into the ground, because trust me, you crash. It drops you mathematically like as fast as you can without guaranteeing injury. It's not like you're floating around up there with the handles,
picking
your spot.
Yeah.
So I pull the line, and I hear my bag hit the ground. And I'm like, what? I mean, it was nighttime. And then you just burn in after that. And they all come riding up to me on golf carts and everything. And they're like, I was already working on your obituary, man. I thought for sure you were dead. And I look up and I was like the 38th jumper out the door. I was by far the first one on the ground. Everyone else was still hundreds of feet above me.
Yeah.
So apparently I had kicked out of a full chute malfunction, and they were all yelling, pull your reserve the whole way down. And they're like, I've never seen anybody do that. Like, good thing you kicked as hard as you did. But yeah, so like I realized right away, like, damn, I almost died here. Didn't like that. And then the Army does a good job of just reminding you of all the risks before you do anything. And, so yeah, they'd always show you the biceps getting torn off and tell you the stories about people. So they get you as nervous as they can each time.
Perfect.
Yeah. Not to be recommended. So people always go, oh, I went skydiving. And I'm like, no, that sounds fun, but trust me, you know.
Yeah.
You don't want to be kitted up with a rifle on, you know, next to your huevos and then take a nice burn in on the ground. It's never fun.
Yeah, it does not sound fun. So, how long were you in the military for? Did you come out and get that VA loan? Was it mission accomplished?
Yeah. Yeah. This house is a big part of that. The VA actually bought me, my house in Seattle 4 years ago. And the thing almost doubled in value. I bought it at exactly the right time. And you know, that's one of the most equitable investments I've ever made. That's the best benefit of the VA, of the whole part of being a VA, if you use it right, is that VA home loan. I've been trying to get them to extend that. I was on a podcast recently as like an advocate for Black people. I guess they'd seen me talking online and like some of the things I said. And they were talking about reparations and should we do that? And they didn't like that my answer was no, but they liked the idea that what maybe we should look at is like a VA home loan for African Americans, kind of like they would do with Native Americans. If you can prove your lineage back to the thing, you know what I mean? Then you can,
yeah.
So we should be doing something just like that and going, look, but here's what we will do for you. VA home loan allows you to own the homes you live in, the businesses you work in. And they were like, oh, that's a good one. And I'm like, yeah, I know. I think that's a good one. But that's a great program, man. I mean, I think it's good for everybody, that especially veterans and people that private citizens own their home, is getting harder and harder and harder.
Right. Yeah. So then when you got back, right, so you do this stuff in the military, excuse me, you, what was like the first business thing that you got yourself involved in? Cause just knowing you over the last 30 minutes, I would imagine you're not somebody that's going to be just come home from the military and sit on your hands for the rest of your life.
No, no, no.
So what did you get up to after that?
So I was actually dating a girl, and her dad owned a car dealership. And so I got back and kind of went and worked for them. And, you know, they're very ethical, good people, but they had no idea how to run a sales organization, which a car dealership is a lot more than just the sales department. You know, I realized that more over time. So I worked for them for a year or two and kind of learned the business, but learned more of what I didn't know. And then ended up actually getting invited to go do the like staffed event sales. So if you've ever gotten a key in the mail suggesting that you want a car or whatever, and we'd line up in a parking lot, and you know, that's really the big league of sales, because people come in thinking that they, you know, want a car and your job is to slow them down and sell them a car.
Yeah.
But I sold cars and I actually have pink slips, which is like the receipt from the sale, from 42 different states. Only missed a few of them, and just got a chance to get out there and really work with a lot of different people, which, you know, for people investing and going to one campus and learning from seven or eight, you know, professors, I would say take that same money and go learn to just stay broke on the road, you know, stay broke in an environment where it's different every week and you're learning from people. But on the job training is always the best. And I actually underestimated how much I knew about the car business until I went and started getting back into like regular dealerships and realized, wow, you know, for me, life has always been like, I step up, I have the shot put in my hand, and I'm like, I'm going to give this my go. I throw it thinking maybe 15 feet would be good, and I throw it 9 feet. I'm like disappointed by that. And then the next guy steps up and throws it 3.5 feet. And then the next guy's 4.5 feet. And I realized, you know, I'm you know, I'm finding my way to success by massively unimpressing myself. So I wasn't as good as I thought I could be or should be, but I was still a lot better than the other people. So yeah, that was my sort of on the job sales training and business training also, because there's a lot to the running those events and getting people to come work for you at the event and getting the marketing out for the event and working with the client to make sure they're satisfied and managing all the customers. And, you know, it was the first thing I'd ever seen where people were regularly making 5 and 10 grand a week as a sales guy. People were making 20, 30 grand a week as a closer or as a manager of the sale, and kind of the same for the person that put the sale on. And the dealership was making a couple hundred grand a week. And it was my first real access to money where I was like, this is money. This isn't like, you know, going around collecting 5s and 10s and 20s. You know, if you catch a piece of the profit here, it's going to be a huge number. And it was the first time I knew people. And this is probably the most influential thing, that we would be out drinking and they'd say, I'd like to get a steak. And they go, the kitchen's closed. And he'd slap $500 on the table and go, call the chef, you know, call the chef, tell him to get back in here. Yeah. And then he would. It was like, it was like, you know what? I didn't know this underbelly of, I didn't know this was a thing. You know, I didn't know you could do that.
Yeah. Just, just like a movie. That's only in movies. It's not, you know,
yeah.
Right. Yeah.
But nope, it's going on every day in some dark room that you're not allowed in because somebody already paid the chef.
Right.
So that was my first access to like the plentiful mindset, where it was like, man, maybe this isn't about just owning your own home. Maybe this is about, you know, doing what it takes to find your peers so that you can make really an exceptional income and have a different go of things. It's not just, you know, ending up on the upper layer of middle class. Maybe I can do a lot more than I realized here, because at the end of the day, you're sizing yourself up compared to people who are making a phenomenal living and going, I still think I could do better than them. I mean, they're them and I'm me, but if I aim my ship towards their island, I think I could do even better.
Right. So talk to me also about when the video production company started, because that was geared towards the automotive industry. Was that something that you saw maybe as an opportunity to kind of provide a service to this industry and maybe try to separate yourself and grow quickly? Is that
Well, so I had a little brother and he was always into video. I was always into video as well, but he was very, very into post-production techniques and had made some really cool stuff. There's videos of us out there fighting each other with lightsabers, you know, when we were 13.
Yeah.
And so he was always into that. And what happened was I kind of started getting into the road thing in a way where I realized these really aren't the people I want to have as my peers, whether it was child support or alimony or whatever, all that money they were making never ended up in their pockets. It ended up in some, you know, chef's pocket maybe, but they just,
you got to get that.
You know, there wasn't anybody I could look at and go, I'm going to be you in 10 years. Cause I started to realize all the people that I was sort of aiming my ship for their island were stranded on that island. They didn't know how to go back to a regular life. This quick hit, quick money thing was all they knew. But by the time they afforded the suits and the lifestyle and the travel and everything else and paid alimony, there wasn't anything left for them. And so I just was like, I got to get out of this. And it's very hard. I mean, when you can leave your house and make 5 or 10 grand in a week, it's very hard to go, I'm not going to do that anymore. It's like quitting drugs or something, you know?
Yeah.
All my friends would be like, how did you get out of it? And I said, well, I just committed that I wouldn't go back. That was the rub. So I actually got a dog, man. That's the story. And I got that dog because I knew that it would prohibit me from leaving again like that. And so I got a dog and I got a regular car sales job at a regular dealership that I despised working with them. I thought they were all dummies. And I called my shot on this. I had told people my plan is to go somewhere that I'll hate. Take the button of a car. I'm going to take the bus there every morning. You know what I mean? And what I'm going to do is I'm going to live in that hatred for my situation. And I'm going to invent a way out. Like you would think to yourself, if you went to prison, you might write a book, but you won't write a book in your regular life. That type of thought process.
Yeah.
And so I'm there looking around, what kind of business could I do? I'm evaluating how much the different vendors are getting paid to provide different solutions, like pictures for the cars or whatever. And they started paying this guy like $500 or $600 for as a spiff, like a bonus for this kid that had just made like a rap video about the Ford Fiesta. And I thought, man, that is, you know, so I could probably do better than that. So eventually I kind of go to them and pitch them that, and they buy a package of like $3,000 a month to make them 6 videos a month. And then that which was golden. And they actually hired us to take pictures of their cars too. And then when that GM was leaving, he had been influential to a bunch of people in the community. And I said, well, let me make you a thank you video for your career. Yeah. Why don't you give me the names of the GMs that you've helped get to their job, and I'll go do it for you out of pocket. So he connected me with 5 or 6 GMs in the marketplace. Again, fill the pipeline, right? I'm not afraid that they tell me no, but if I can get in front of them and get them to hear me out, now they're saying maybe, then no, versus just, I don't even know who this kid is. Yeah. And long story short, all 6 of them decided they needed videos too. And then at some point we were like, wow, okay. So then I started speaking and realized, wow, so that went well too. People quite like what I have to say on this topic.
Yeah.
But I realized I had a guy come up to me and say, so if I wanted to invest $1 million with you, how many videos could you make in a year? And I realized that was a capped number because it was so intensive. We'd go in and everything was a custom production. So we actually had a patent to digitally swap the license plate. You know, every dealership has their own license plate.
Yeah.
And so we would make a series of like walk around videos for, say, the Ford product and all their product lines and explanations of their warranty and all this stuff. And then it was made very cleverly so that I could rebrand it, because a dealership, they don't advertise nationally.
Yeah.
So I would sell you my Ford series in your Cleveland market, and you'd be my Ford partner in your Cleveland market, which is still how I run my ad agency. So we come with all these assets that look and feel like they were made for them, uniquely to them. And then we would, and then this way we could make the product once and sell it 50 times in theory. So we got to the point where we were making thousands of automotive videos. We had 8, 9 employees, and we started to realize that dealers, they just didn't know what to do with these videos. You know, the video is about getting the right message in front of the right person at the right time.
Right.
We'd give them the right message, but they didn't know how to find the right person, and they couldn't dictate when the timing was that they would see this video. They just leave it on a YouTube and like, that's not how it works, you know? And around that same time, we started dabbling with Facebook ads, and we realized, oh crap. So it turns out that a simple video made with a cell phone of a person talking that looks like an Instagram story, about double outperforms our fancy graphics and radio. And we're panicking because I'm sitting on $200,000 worth of gear, 10 employees. That's not what I wanted to hear at the time.
Right.
So we sort of pivoted slightly as a Facebook agency just to make some waves, and ended up selling that video business in place to an existing ad agency. And then that's kind of where what led us here is they paid me to not work for a year, which was probably a mistake. And, I sat around and thought, well, if I was going to build an ad agency, how would I build it? What would we do? So that's sort of our thing now, is we still make all this duplicitous content for all these different purposes, for based on the day a week, based on the product that they've looked at, based on things like the profession perhaps of that prospect. And so all of this stuff is hyper targeted, and now we get to control it. So now the videos come free, you know, as when they hire me as their agency, and we sort of control when the customer sees it, how they see it, how it feels to see it. And we've sort of built this like conversational thing because we're the video guys. So we could back our way into the idea going, well, if you got 30 videos, how would you use them?
Yeah.
Which most people, they're like, I would never have 30 videos. So I don't even care about what that solution would look like. And that has been just unbelievably productive. You know, the clients see a car, they see whatever. We have other clients as well. And then the next day we have a follow-up message, and what they do with that message, whether they watch all of it, watch none of it, click, don't click, that dictates the next ad they see. So when you have all this content, it sort of creates this like facsimile of a conversation where they're always referencing something you did last, or a product that you looked at, or a time of day that it is right then. And it kind of feels like the internet's talking to you. You know, we like to call it an ad bot. So similar premise to a chat bot. It's just, right. It's dictating which ad you see and when you see it and how you see it. And that's been the rub, man. I mean, the videos are cool, but people overestimate what a video can do.
Yeah.
And a video's job is not to, it's not a magic trick. All the video does is allow someone to see you, hear you, decide if they like you, hear your voice inflection. It's just you. It's just a way of getting you out there.
Yeah.
But if you don't get yourself out there at the right time, in the right way, with the right message, with the right message length, in the right format, whether it's square or tall, you know, those are the things that matter. And you see people making videos that are 5 minutes long, making videos that are, you know, meant to be organic. And so you just have to, now it's more about the delivery, I guess, is what I'm trying to say, than it is the video, which is where that business ended up. Is it's not about making one beautiful video. It's about having a conversation with the customer and just using video as a medium to get your face in front of them at the right time.
Exactly. I feel like that's the same. That's with anything. I mean, I could do this podcast and just shout into the void forever, but if I never put it in front of the right people, no one's ever going to hear this conversation that you and I are having right now. And then that's just been something that I've learned over time, find out where the community is and make it, almost like conversational. So you're trying to connect them with that message and whatever medium you're using to do that. That's like the most important thing. So I 100% agree with that. One of the things that you mentioned though, in that answer that I didn't want to gloss over. So as a baseball guy, I heard you say called your shot. Can you tell us more about the philosophy behind calling your shot?
Well, it's deep. It's a deep river. But I think part of it is you know, if you've ever read like Think and Grow Rich or some of these books, they always talk about, you know, telling your goals to other people. And I think there's a multitude of reasons why that really matters. And one of the jokes that, you know, I always talk about is if there was going to be something written on my tombstone, I'd want it to say something to the effect of, you know, here lays Andrew Myers. If he tells you it's going to rain, go find an umbrella. Because I think as you create that in your community or in your reality of the people who know you, when they know that you're going to do something you say you're going to do, the universe wants it to happen. And I could talk for 30 minutes about why I have my own metaphysical explanations for why it triggers this result. But I think if I tell you something is going to happen and you think to yourself, he's probably going to do that, then, you know, if you look at the mini worlds theory or the parallel, you know, the universe is building all these different versions, but it's always looking to do that economically, right? It's looking to do it with the least effort.
Right.
So if I explain something that I'm going to do and everyone hears me, knows me and thinks, yeah, he's probably going to do it, the universe has no reason to build a universe where I don't do it. Everybody expects me to do it. So it'll give you the serendipity and the luck and the omens. It'll push you towards that eventuality because no one expects it not to happen. And also, I think there's some real world reasons why obviously you putting that idea foremost in your mind matters, right? So yeah, I'm somebody who sort of moves from thing to thing, and I take a lot of pride in calling my shot and telling people, this is where you're going to see me next. This is what I'm going to be doing when you see me next, and having that be what ends up happening, right?
Yeah. Well, I think I forget who I had on this show, and they were talking about something similar, and they were talking about the idea that like, you could sit there and say, I want to do this, or I want to be a millionaire. I want to be a marketing genius. I want to be the best podcaster in the world. But unless like you actually do something about it and be like, no, this is what I'm going to do. Like you just said, it doesn't actually like come to fruition because if you just say, I want to do this, you never actually put the plan in place or actually take the steps necessary to actually get it done.
They say when you're writing your affirmations, you really should be writing them in past tense.
Yeah.
So if you want to become the best podcaster, the affirmation needs to sound more like, I'm so glad I woke up focused and stayed focused each day on the skills I'd need to become the best podcaster that there is. And I'm glad I'm here now. That's a more productive affirmation because it's really about burning the ships. It's about telling yourself there's nowhere else to go but this result. This has to be the result. And as much as it matters that you convince yourself, I personally believe it matters that you convince the people around you.
Yeah.
And, you know, and that's a whole nother train of thought, but I do think that, you know, people underestimate the power of words. You know, words create spells, whether they're a spell on you or a spell on other people. So, you know, I see sort of a real world reason while having your goals in your pocket and calling your shot matters. I see sort of this enchanting reason where like people who believe in you are likely to want to help you get where you're going. And if you say something's going to happen and they know you're going to go either way, they'll spend their time helping you instead of talking you out of it. But then I also see this very goofy sort of metaphysical, you know, multi-worlds theory where the universe doesn't want to create 40 versions. If they can just create 3 versions where you get what you want and everybody else gets what they expected to see, If nobody, you know, they're doubting you, then there's no need to build a world to satisfy that reality.
Right. Yeah. And I love that you said burn the ships. That is my second favorite quote of all time, or second favorite phrase, I guess. But
there you go.
Love that. Love that. So
I was gonna say, so we have fear of being late because our moms were always late in common, and burn the ships. Now I just got to find out what your number one is. We'll be on our way.
Oh, I'll tell you what it is.
Yeah, please do.
It's a Gandhi quote as told by Mike Ham. So, you know, obviously I'm much more worldly and enlightened than a Gandhi, but, the quote is, if you're going to be a bear, be a grizzly. So if you're going to do something, why wouldn't you want to be the biggest, most badass version of that thing that you could possibly be? Yep. That is my favorite quote. I think it's, you know, that's how I try at least to live life. Like, if I'm going to do something, we're all in. I don't care. You know, it doesn't matter what kind of hand I was dealt at that particular moment in time. We're going to figure it out and we're going all in. Like, that's how we just got to do things.
Yeah. YOLO. My version of that, which is easily in my top three as well, is anything worth doing well.
Yeah. Right. Love it. Yeah. Did we just become best friends? Yeah.
I think so. We'd be hugging right now if we were in a bar. People would be watching us.
Yeah. Be like, what the hell's wrong with these guys? So at the beginning of the, and you might be the segue king, because at the beginning of that answer, when I asked you about calling your shot, you said it was a deep river. And one of the things that I know, the phrase that you have coined, we're talking about phrases and quotes, was river of thought. Can you explain to us what the river of thought is?
So it's something that I used to have people over. We'd get drunk and I'd draw on the whiteboard to kind of explain some of these philosophies. And so essentially the river of thought is just an imagery for what I just described. If you imagine a rock in a river and where all the water kind of bangs around the rock and gets into a channel, that is essentially what I'm describing when I talk about people's expectations, that if all these expectations can sort of be herded into one spot, that the universe, there's like a pressure there to create more outcomes that are like the one you've sold everybody on, that you've sold yourself on, that you've been doing affirmations about. And if there's two versions of the universe built, perhaps you can pick which one you're consciously connected to. And that's why if you focus on a negative outcome, you'll always find it. I remember when I was a kid, I heard the word cleavage for the first time. Never heard it. Someone like, what's that? And they're like, that's the part of girls' boobs you can see when they wear a low cut shirt. I'm like, huh, I like that word. And then I heard it like seven times in the next week, you know, yeah. And that, you know, that's not a rare phenomenon, because all this stuff's happening and you're just not paying attention to it. Yeah. So when you pay attention to something and you keep it on the forefront, if how do I become the world's best podcaster is something you're asking yourself, you know, 30, 40 times a day, and you're able to hold it right here. I always say, like, really wanting a goal is like being asked to go, hey, you want a Ferrari? Right. I want a Ferrari on this 12-ounce glass of water. And if you can hold it up for 3 months without putting it down, without being distracted by it, you can have it. And that really is the way I kind of see the world. And part of it is because I feel like it aggregates people's thoughts and expectations. This is that river of thought that, you know, right where that you're even water headed down, and then there's a big rock and you can see all, the thoughts can't go there. So where do they go? They push around them. So I feel like it forces whoever's creating multiple dimensions of universe here to create more of them that are in line with that outcome that, like I said, you've convinced everybody is coming either way. You're convinced, you've been looking for it all day, like the word cleavage. So as you're watching TV, you're going, you're seeing something that somebody on Good Morning America did with their paperwork, and you're thinking, that was slick how they did that. That would make you a better podcaster. You're watching podcasts, you see where somebody put the microphone, you're like, that's a good idea. That would make me a better podcaster. Whereas if you're not holding that, you're not suspending your attention. You know, attention is the only currency we have. And if you allow your attention to go wherever it wants to go, then you're going to be drug in competing directions and everything else. But if you're always headed towards one spot, which is kind of what it looks like the water's doing when it hits a, you know, you're watching it 20 feet away, you know, the boulder's coming and you know what's going to happen when they get there.
Right.
If you can get people to look at, you know, the outcomes you've predicted in that same way, then I just feel like it's less work for the universe to just push everybody through that channel like a speed shoot and give you the thing that everybody expects you to have, even if it's illogical. Because I can tell you, most of the things I've done in my life have been based on luck. So here I am working my butt off on this thing, and then I get what I was working for, but not for that reason. I was, something else happens that makes it happen, you know? So I always joke, you know, if I'm God, or if I'm, you know, a deity looking down at all the, you know, I'm looking at these monkeys and the monkeys are working for something, and be it a cache of bananas, and I get to decide who gets the bananas. It's up to me. It's like, I'm king of the ant farm. I'm going to give the bananas to the monkey that's working the hardest. So if I see a monkey out there just chopping away at trees, one tree falls, it goes to the next one. The other ones are resting and he's just chopping this tree. I want him to get the bananas. So I'm going to find a way to get those bananas in his possession. And it may have nothing to do with the trees that he's whacking away at.
Right.
So, you know, I've always kind of just believed in this idea that, you know, that the outcome is never going to be attached to the work, but they're also inseparable because that's you convincing yourself you're worthy of the bananas. It's maybe you convincing a watcher that you're worthy of the bananas. So yeah, that has always been just like sort of a philosophy. Again, a lot of this stuff, I don't normally mention to people because they're like, you sound like a whack job, but you know, I don't wake up and think about these things, but they are, if asked, that's essentially my philosophy for the world is that, you know, I write my goals down. I've got a book here next to me that's got all my to-do lists written down analog. And, you know, I just have certain relationships with the world where I feel like once I've satisfied this, once I've done this or done enough of this, then I'll get this. And it's like writing a check to yourself. And I always tell my wife, be careful what you write on that check, because I know you can probably speak to this as well, but it feels like you don't ever get the thing you thought you were asking for, but you get a thing that does fit the check line, the way you said it. You know, I want to be this or that. And you get that, but it's not what you were picturing you were going to get. So you got to be careful what you write on the subject line of that check, the wording you use.
Yeah, exactly.
But yeah, I mean, I've always believed in that. I don't think the world's that serious. And I've also only known what I've seen. And I've seen people who live like that always get what they want. And then everyone who didn't do the work they did stand back and point out correctly how lucky they were. And it's like, they're both right.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. No, I mean, it may sound like different and outside the box, but that is how, I mean, that's how we introduced you at the very beginning of this. As we were talking, you've just always been a little bit more outside the box and whatever gets the job done. You know what I mean? I think that there's, even though that may not be how everybody approaches stuff. And we talked about that too, about how maybe like your parents are maybe were saying something different or maybe how you should approach life or whatever. But then you've put yourself into these positions to have success and do different things and connect with different people. So you've seen the way that the world works. You know what I mean? The way people interact within that world, the different parts of the world and all that kind of stuff. So I think that that's really cool. And I think that that's, you know, a fantastic, some fantastic ways to approach all these things that we're talking about. So usually we ask people on this show about goals, but I'm going to ask you, what shots are you currently calling right now?
Ooh, that's a good one.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. I've worked hard on that one.
You're right. Just came to me.
Well, I'm in a weird spot now because the businesses that I've made, I've sort of backed into. We built a business from zero clients, zero intellectual property, zero process in 18 months to a $3.5 million agency during a pandemic. Most of our clients are auto dealers and now they don't have any inventory. And so we had seen the writing on the wall that maybe it's not best to have all of our business in this space. So right now we're sizing up a pivot to some other industry. And it's funny you say that, because I was just saying until maybe 2 weeks ago, I really didn't know which bleacher to point to.
Yeah.
We sized up doing, you know, we look for high ticket clients. So we're looking for solar, we're looking for injury attorneys, you know, things like that. And we had just recently decided that the thing we're going to do is I've been working on this training course for our clients that show them how to pull out a cell phone and create this really meaningful, engaging content. They can feed it to us. And then I know the process to make sure that only the right people see it. Right. So if you make an ad for Spanish speakers, I can actually make sure that any people in your funnel, watching your content, looking at your products that also speak Spanish, get that ad served to them. And it's very inexpensive. But what's missing is that ability to create the content. So, you know, even our competitive agencies, they would probably like to do this too, but for them creating the content's impossible. It's a barrier to entry. So they do what they can without it. So yeah, our next shot that we're calling is I'm actually going to monetize an entire course. It's the thing we've been building for clients. It shows everything from lighting, framing, how to grip the phone, how to sound. And this is all on a cell phone. This isn't bringing things into Premiere. And then the big one is scripting, how to tell meaningful, engaging, relevant, short, compact scripts that actually motivate the person hearing them. And it's not like, you know, the biz dev or the biz brothers that you had on that are really focused on one great piece of content that'll gain you awareness. This is little pithy statements that are very concise, meant to be impactful and meaningful and topical, and then get in and out. And so we go over how to actually create those for your business. There's an algorithm. We talk about how to create other types of videos, like video capture videos, boomerangs, how to jump into like TikTok and sort through the funny things and find ways to riff on them so that they fit for your business.
Yeah.
You know, we have sample kits and there's coaching involved and all that. So we're actually backing up now and learning ClickFunnels and the last piece of our e-commerce thing here. We know the videos, we know the paid ads. And so that's the shot we're calling is we're trying to build a course and hit, you know, hit the six figure or a seven figure mark for that course. And then parlay that knowledge of how to build these click funnels and landing pages and then go do solar and everything else. But yeah, I'm for the first time. I mean, I'm pretty comfortable. I've got a few dollars I haven't spent yet in life, but I've also got my team and we're a very small team and they're all younger than me and they're all getting married and having families. And so I wake up thinking about how to plow enough field for them to be where I am in a few years.
Yeah.
And it's weird because now it's the first time I've ever picked a business, not had a reputation, not had, you know, we went from 8 clients that knew me and then we got referrals and had 10 and then 12 and then 15 and then 20 and then 25 and then 30 and 35. And we've not ever advertised or picked up the phone or prospected or anything. So this would be the first time I've ever like decided that's a business I want to own and had to go build it. And it's just enough to get the nerves going again, you know, that right. Feel, what if I fail? What if nobody cares or nobody watches the course or nobody, you know? But yeah, we're doing it because we think the shot we're really calling is that these skill sets are going to really add something to our existing clients, the ability to, you know, promote a different type of product, to really figure out this course so they can, their employees can use it more easily, and to figure out these landing pages, and how to easily make them quickly and on the fly. We're hiring a ClickFunnels guy. Our next course is not monetary or anything. And it, you know, it's really weird. I had a bunch of shots I had called, and last year I woke up in $1 million house with 2 beautiful kids and my wife's kicking ass on her Peloton and the business has hit this goal. And I realized I'm afraid to pull out in traffic now, cause these are the only goals I've ever had. I never planned a life beyond this. You know what I mean? I don't know what I'm doing anymore.
Right.
And so, yeah, we had to kind of take a minute and go, well, what does the next chapter look like? And I now kind of wake up and put myself in the shoes of my employees and go, how do I get them where they need to go? And that's become the new motivation, because for them to get there, I have to go somewhere else in order to provide that opportunity for them. But it's really not about, you know, that for me, but the next shot is skilling them up and watching them grow as business owners, because I really give them the keys to the castle and you know, finding a few other breadlines for the business, a few other chaunches to steal from the girl on Undercover Billionaire. Did you watch that show?
I did not. I mean, I've seen Undercover Undercover Boss. That's the one that I was thinking of.
This is the you have no money and you have to build $1 million business in 90 days.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Got a lot of funny things to say about that show. It was a trip, let's say. But yeah, so that's the next goal is, you know, get off, you know, it's like the Who Moved My Cheese thing, right?
Yeah.
We've got this nice pile of cheese, but you just get this feeling that it isn't going to be there forever. So we're looking now just to expand out. And that's part of the other thing with the course is we want to meet more people who like what we're talking about and can kind of become part of our army, either as clients or as employees or as resellers or as, you know, so we're just going out and meeting the people. I haven't spoken anywhere in 2 years. We've just been building this thing. So we're sort of aimless at the moment. We just have this focus on building this course and building this funnel as good as it possibly can be. And then seeing where the rivers take us.
Yeah, no, I think it's great. And it's something that I've tried to do more and more, especially over the last year and a half at this point, try to put more video stuff out there, try to see what works, what resonates with the audience, what doesn't. And just on my own sales side, I mean, I've seen a lot of success. And I think that is, you know, due to the fact that I've been putting a lot of stuff out there and have tried to refine where I put it, who I put it in front of and all that kind of stuff. So I think that's awesome. And I would definitely want to check that out as well. So I've already kept you longer than I said I would. So we're going to move this into our closing segment, which we call Under the Spotlight. So Spotlighters have been talking to Mike Hamm and Andrew Myers talk for 50 plus minutes at this point. And we've talked about a lot. We didn't get to everything that I wanted to talk about, but maybe that's something for another episode down the line, a little call back to the morning spotlight. So what would be one thing that you would want the spotlighters to walk away from this episode with? So you're under the spotlight.
All right. Well, read The Alchemist and read Think and Grow Rich. If you want a synopsis of, you know, some of that metaphysical goal setting and omen interpreting, go do those two things for yourself. You'll be thankful. But to focus this on, you know, on who my target audience typically is. For those that currently own or run a business, for those that are currently looking to start a business, really being aware of how easy that is to do with Facebook is so important. And if you can start with how easy it is, if you're a business owner and I say someone's coming to your business, they're looking at this product and they're this age and they live from this city. If you're good at your job, then what you'd say to them would be different than somebody from a different city with a different sex looking at a different product. And if you learn how to use your cell phone to create basically video voicemails for these people, you can not only tell who clicks your ad or not, but you can tell how much of the ad they watched. So if you follow me on this, this allows you to play 100,000 impressions to people and not just get clicks or no clicks. You can get video views. You can see how much of this video did they view, and kind of like I was doing with the toy sales, put them in that maybe bucket where they haven't said yes and they haven't said no. So let's keep paying to talk to them. And we've grown every type of business there is with this approach. So if there's a resource, we're going to offer it to you guys free, for listeners of the podcast, go to parachutevideoads.com. Which is just where our business is hosted right now, where we're going to put this podcast and there or this course. And we have a course, Little Videos, Big Results. It's a business development course, and it'll show you everything about how to hold the phone, work the phone, write the scripts, and how to make not one video for your business, but 10 or 12 videos that have unique purposes. And I haven't met a business owner yet that when they hear about this, they either say, I didn't know Facebook could work like that. I didn't know I had the option to serve ads like that. Or I didn't know how easy it was to make this content. It doesn't need music. It doesn't need titles. It's literally just point the camera at somebody, follow the rules so it doesn't look terrible. Boom. Right. So yeah, if there's any takeaway, I want business owners to understand that you don't have a business until you know how much it costs you to get another client. And one of the stories I always tell is my mom was the first entrepreneur I ever knew. She quit her bank job, picked me up at daycare and said, I'm not working there anymore. I'm now going to clean houses. And in a week, she found all the clients she needed to fill her schedule up. But my mom never made the connection that she was better at finding clients than she was cleaning houses. So she never put the bottle of 409 down. And if she was smart, she would have kept finding those clients at that rate and had somebody else cleaning the houses and would have had $1 million cleaning business. And she didn't think of it because business owners do the thing they're passionate about. Right. And they look at the growth of the business as somebody else's job. Right. So the best thing about doing these Facebook ads in this way is that once you build this sort of architecture that these video, if you get somebody in your funnel, you know, they're going to get this experience and then that one, and then you're going to come back a day later and try to convert them and then come back and go, hey, why didn't you click on that last ad? You know, you're going to really give them an honest shot. When you build that, you can rinse that down and say, you know, we have a client that just has an auction company and he said he'd pay $5 or $10 to get somebody to register to bid in the auction. And we ran, you know, a couple grand worth of ad spend and he learned, holy crap, it costs 38 cents to get somebody to register for an auction. So you don't have a business. You're just working for yourself. You do not have a business until you know how much it costs you to get another customer. And when you advertise in this way, you can eventually say, hey, you know, as a real estate person, it cost me $180 to get another lead to do their mortgage or to sell them, you know. So for business owners, I want the key takeaway to be this course is free. We're going to have a link there that you can download. It'll be up on for the week that you guys have. This podcast is live and you can download it for free. If you have any questions, reach out to me, you know, directly. But I want people to understand that you can get good at the part of your business that matters, which is going and getting the next client. If you have an olive oil shop or if you have a skateboard shop, somebody else can buy and hang the skateboard. Somebody else can, you know, you could have three stores instead of zero. Your whole business comes down to your ability to find that next customer. And so don't sleep on that opportunity. Don't spend another 4 days getting better at cleaning houses and no days getting better at finding new people with dirty houses.
Right. Right. Awesome. So let's hit them with the links. I know you said parachutevideoads.com. What yep. other links? Are there any other links that we need to make sure that the spotlighters are aware of?
Yeah. So my handle is Emerstan, Emerstan, Emerstan. So I have, you know, Twitter at Emerstan, Facebook at Emerstan, Instagram at Emerstan. Anyone can find me there real, real easily. You can always Google Mr. Wronghouse, which is something we didn't get into.
Yeah, right. Silly. That was the other thing that I wanted to talk about. Yeah.
Yeah. The other little viral video. You can Google that if you want a good laugh of a would-be home invader getting a hilarious looking beating on the camera. You can always find me that away.
Yeah.
And then again, parachute video ads. And that'll be where you can download this course for free. There's going to be no charge for it for a couple of days. We're not going to do that obviously forever, but we're giving it away for the first few podcasts we're on here, just to make sure that we can get it to a few people, make sure that their input's there on it. So no money has to change hands.
Yep.
And you can always find me at emerstan@gmail.com.
Awesome. Awesome. I will make sure I put all those in the show notes, as well as themorningspotlight.com and themorningspotlight@gmail.com. Andrew, thank you so much for coming on with us today. I know we didn't get to everything that I wanted to talk about, but we covered so much. This episode was awesome. I really appreciate you coming on with us today.
Hey, thank you, man. You're a grizzly bear.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Nice tie-in. And the Spotlighters, thank you for listening, and we will catch you next time. Hey everyone, thanks for listening. Just a reminder that any views expressed in the Morning Spotlight are the views of the speaker and should not be construed to be the views of any other person, any employer, or any organization. Thank you. We'll see you next week.